Well, as I said, we've been talking about what it takes to be a man of God, what that is, what it takes to make one, why this is so important. As I said in a recent lesson, a man of God is not merely a man who goes to church or prays or reads his Bible, but rather one who makes Christ as Lord in his heart and surrenders his life to the Lord. The success or failure of many marriages or families can be directly attributed to whether or not a man chooses to follow Christ or something or someone else. And this has, therefore, far-reaching effects, even eternal effects, if you think about it. So in the lessons, I've shown that good leadership of the family begins with good followership of Jesus Christ. Those who internalize that virtue, that attitude, that selflessness, that purity of Jesus Christ make excellent husbands and excellent fathers. And I would dare to say that any woman would be glad to have such a man who is following Christ as her husband, and any child should be very appreciative toward any father who chooses to follow the Lord himself. God has a plan for men as to how to govern themselves and their households. Admittedly, it's not a very detailed plan. It doesn't have to be, because it provides an overarching perspective of the kind of attitudes and behaviors that he expects. Not all Christians follow this plan, of course. Not all Christian families follow that plan. And those who do not suffer greatly. And there's that word suffer there that really should be emphasize there. People suffer when the plan is not followed. And this is evident then in unproductive marriages, uncontrolled children, those who are lacking in spiritual direction. And the saddest part of all that is it just doesn't have to be that way. Okay? It just doesn't have to be that way. There's a better method. There's a better plan. And my lesson this morning is not to beat up people and saying, there you go, this is your situation, and don't you feel bad about yourself now. Okay, that's not my intention. My intention is to draw attention to the fact that we can do it wrongly, but then also how to do it right and give you the encouragement to do that rightly. And I hope that you will take that positively. Families that are guided by positive Christ-centered leadership often do well. The marriages are rewarding and productive. The children are grounded in spiritual values, often grow up to become good, faithful Christians, and have a healthy respect for the Lord. Our endeavor, then, is to be that kind of family, or to at least support that kind of family. If indeed your family's already grown up, at least be supportive of that in other people's families, in the church especially. Well, as we said in another lesson, families are intelligent groups of people that need to be organized and need to be led. They can't function well without structure and stability. And they can't function well without direction and well-defined goals. And those goals need to be communicated by the leader of that family to the family and also enforced over time. It's not enough just to say, okay, family, this is what we need to do. You also need to enforce that as is needed. Maybe by recommunicating that or by correction or even by other means of enforcement as is necessary. A family can survive without this, but it's not going to fulfill what God intended. Keep in mind, God invented the family. We did not. He invented marriage. We did not. So whatever he invented or created for us and then gave to us as a gift is really that which is in our very best interest. But imagine a football team in its huddle, and the quarterback says to the players, well, I'm not sure what we're doing here. Everyone just do whatever you think you want to do, and we'll just run with it, right? Someone's thinking back to earlier Seahawks seasons where pretty much that's what happened, I think. But you know that this leads to chaos and that team is certain to lose the game. And so what we're looking at then is we understand that sports teams, they need to be organized and they also need leadership. They need to be led. If that's so important for a secular sports, then why shouldn't it be important for spiritual-minded families? Well, of course, it should be. It is unacceptable to deny that organization, that leadership, and yes, that communication that is so necessary for Christian families to survive. So we're going to take a look at, real quickly, what disorganized families look like, or families that lack that leadership. By the way, as I go through this, it occurred to me as I was writing this lesson that this isn't just about families, like, you know, my family or your family. This is also about congregations. Okay? You'll see congregations acting exactly like I'm going to be talking about families here. So that's something for us to sit up and take notice of. Okay? There are some families living on in a perpetual, what we might call, survival mode. These are families that really live on the brink of collapse every day. They have no plan B, and it's not even clear what plan A is. They often live from crisis to crisis, their lives marked from one crisis or family fight or meltdown after another. And in such situations, it's very stressful. It's always stressful, in fact, and everyone feels it. Everyone in the family is doing whatever they can to get as much attention or acceptance as possible. Everyone in the family is searching for identity, but they don't really know what their identity should look like. So they're constantly grasping for something that is elusive. The house is usually in a state of clutter or disorganization or disrepair because the family is this same way. Physical surroundings often mirror the mental, emotional, even the spiritual state of the family itself. That's one type of family. Here's another one, the catatonic zombie family, okay? I know zombies are real popular now, so why not, right? These are people that are drifting passively from day to day who really don't have any goals, no objectives, no ambition. Everyone's just doing their own thing. Each member disconnected from the other. Dad's glued to the laptop. Mom's glued to the TV. The kids are enslaved to video games. Everyone content to be disconnected and unconcerned about the other. Rarely do they sit down to a meal together, and even when they do, as soon as someone's done, they get up and go back to their, you know, their cave or retreat back into their isolation there. And by the way, all of this seems extremely normal to this family. This is normal. There's little or no teaching going on. They just follow a daily routine. There's no sense of unity, no sense of urgency, no real leadership. Everyone's just doing what is right in their own eyes. And still other families live in a perpetual state of superficiality, projecting, in essence, a false image of what they want people to think of them, but not necessarily having the substance of that. Perhaps they sit down to a Bible study just so that they can say that they did, but no one really believes what they're learning. Therefore, no one really lives like what that word teaches them, and yet they walk away saying, well, I'm good enough. Or dad makes decisions, puts his foot down, but everyone knows that it's really mom who's the real leader in the family, and she can revoke his decisions or undermine his authority whenever she wants to. And as a result, dad gets frustrated, unfulfilled, depressed, seeks to address these feelings, perhaps with some secret addiction. And then mom pretends to be supportive, the supportive wife, the caring mother, but inside she is terribly unhappy, terribly despondent. She truly wants her husband to lead, but at the same time, she doesn't want to let go of her own passive-aggressive controlling behavior. So she knows she's supposed to be submissive, but honestly doesn't trust her husband to steer, so she pretends to be submissive while manipulating things behind the scenes. Again, think of congregations as well as families. The kids in such a scenario act obedient, polite, well-behaved when they need to or when others are looking. But they've been watching this little charade go on for years, and they look for opportunities to exploit it to their own advantage. This is called playing parents against each other. I think all kids know what I'm talking about. They're so disgusted, they simply look for an opportunity to recoil and rebel in a way that hurts their parents as much as possible. What I've just outlined here, sadly, is what some families look like, and what's really sad is some Christian families look like this. Remember, families need to be organized. They need to be led. There needs to be communication in that organization and leadership. And when you take those things out, take out organization and or leadership and or communication, this is what you get. These are all too common pictures of family scenarios. And while they seem normal to those who are in them because they don't know anything else, it is anything but normal. In fact, it is often referred to as dysfunctional. A term that reveals a couple of important thoughts. Dysfunctional doesn't mean non-functional. It really means that it is functioning improperly or according to a wrong plan or wrong design. Dysfunctional families still function, so to speak, but they don't function with effectiveness or efficiency. I can illustrate this in such a way. You've probably heard this story before, some of you, but years ago, we were driving our van down to Oregon, and unbeknownst to me, some squirrels had gotten into my engine compartment and had chewed through one of my fuel injector lines that go to one of the lines that go to my fuel injector. So I have a six-cylinder car at the time, and now I'm only going on five cylinders, or at least it's kind of interrupting, you know, in and out. So I'm down in Oregon, suddenly the car starts bucking, and you know, and I'm watching the gas gauge going down almost visibly as we're going along, because the thing is suddenly sucking a whole lot of gasoline. And to get 60 miles an hour out of that thing, I had to keep the pedal to the metal, right? And I had to almost coax the car along, like, you can do it, you can do it. Maybe you've had cars like that. So I'm just trying to get from point A to B, and I am doing it. I'm actually getting there, but I'm doing so very ineffectively and inefficiently. Why? Because the engine wasn't working properly. Because there was a problem there in the system there that interfered with that. Okay, so you might say that was a very dysfunctional trip in the sense that it wasn't effective and it wasn't efficient. And that would be true. A dysfunctional family is very similar. It is underpowered. It is wasting a tremendous amount of energy on a very little amount of productivity. It has a number of issues. Yes, it's still able to exist, but here's where the analogy breaks down. While a dysfunctional engine may get me from point A to point B, a family that is dysfunctional is just spinning in circles, not really going anywhere. And in many cases, that cycle is perpetuated even into the next generation because the children, not knowing anything else, thinking that that is normal, bring that scenario into their own families and so on, until finally someone wakes up and says, enough, we're not going to do this anymore. Dysfunctional is necessarily a departure from that which is fully functional, which necessarily means that there is a master plan of how a family ought to operate and function and prosper. It is amazing to me that we have a lot of secular or godless therapists who are saying there's no God and we don't need the Bible and all this, but then they start talking about dysfunctional families. You can't have dysfunctional unless you know what functional is. And you can't have functional unless there's a master plan. And you can't have a master plan unless you have someone who is intelligent enough and transcendent enough to give that master plan to everybody and for everyone to subscribe to that plan. And when they don't subscribe to that plan, then you can call it dysfunctional. But you can't have it both ways. You can't rub God out of the picture and then talk about dysfunctional families because there's no such thing. If there is no God, then your family is what it is, and it's functional or not, it doesn't really matter. We have no point of reference. But we do have a master plan. We do have a master planner. And he not only knows that plan himself, but he's communicated it to the rest of us. And that's exactly what Scripture provides. God, who knows how the family ought to run, and then communicates that information to us. So when we talk about functional now, we're not talking about merely existing or surviving or heading toward a goal that is self-chosen. And I think a lot of people think this way, like, well, our family functions. Remember what I said? Of course it functions. You can be spinning in circles and thinking that you're functioning, but that's not really what functional means here. Functional is not just surviving. Functional is not just existing. But as you'll see here, first of all, it is existing for a stated purpose. Ultimately, for all people, that purpose should be to honor God and bring him glory. I want you to think about God's stated purpose in the Bible. By the way, this is phrased in one way or the other, all the way from Genesis to Revelation. God says, I will be their God and they will be my people. That's God's stated purpose for having brought us into existence. What should our stated purpose be for our family? To make God our God and for us to be his people. Because that stated purpose is in complete agreement with and compliant with God's stated purpose. God's saying, this is what I want, and the family is saying, and we want the same thing. When you have that agreement, when you have that harmony, now you have functionality, because God is going to give you all the tools and equip you with all the things necessary in order for you to be God's people and in order for him to be your God. So there has to be a stated purpose in which the goals match God's goals and the family's goals. And this is a family that is not just surviving, you know, by the skin of their teeth, as some would say, but rather is flourishing. It is growing in good health. It is stable and structured and consistent. Consistency is a huge part of any good family system. This family knows what is right, knows what is important, knows what is necessary, and, this is key, steadily works to fulfill all those things. Whatever is right, whatever is important, and whatever is necessary. Constantly working to implement those very things. Not just saying, yeah, we know what it is, but we have no clue how to get there, right? No, they know what they are, and they're steadily working toward that. It does not fulfill a self-determined goal like a plan. We have a plan for our family. Well, that's fine, except that unless it's God's plan, it's not going to work. So this is a family that doesn't have a plan. It has the plan. It has God's plan. And it defers to God's wisdom and authority and uncorrupted love. It trusts him and trusts his plan. And what's important, as you see on the screen, is that the family believes that that plan will work and lives according, therefore, to that plan. We trust God's plan. We know it's going to work. And so we're going to do everything in our power to make sure that that plan gets fulfilled, that whatever God tells us to do, we're going to do it because we believe that that is the right way in which to live. Functional does not merely mean church going. Lots of people go to churches that are not functional in individuals, families, or otherwise. It doesn't mean just believing in God. Even the demons were reminded in James chapter 2, believe in God and shudder. They still remain what they are, demons. And it doesn't mean just Bible knowledge. Even atheists have Bible knowledge, but they remain atheists. What functional really means at the core of it is Christ-centered, because no one but genuine Christians can be Christ-centered. Think about that. Churchgoers can't do that. Demons can't do that. Atheists can't do that. Okay? So, churchgoers, atheists, and demons can do those other things that Christians do, but there's one thing that Christians do that no one else can do, and that is to make Christ their God and to make him the center of their life. That's something that only genuine Christians can do. Therefore, Christ is the reason for one's marriage. It's not just, hey, I found a girl and I want to get married. Okay? Christ is the reason for the marriage plan and the marriage itself. Christ is the reason for having children. Christ is the reason for one's entire belief system. Christ is the reason for life itself. He is the reason. And again, this master plan is simple and defined in very general terms, but just because the terms and instructions are general doesn't mean they're any less important. And so the New Testament scripture describes a functional household in this way. First of all, you have a man and a woman who are married when they are joined together by law to each other and in God's sight. Okay, so it's a legal or legitimate relationship that entitles them to the rights and privileges of that relationship. If you're not married and just living together or just, you know, trying to get the perks and benefits of a physical relationship, if you know what I'm talking about here, but you're outside of that marriage, well, you have no right to that. You're not entitled to that. It's marriage that gives you that right. It's marriage that provides that God-given context for you to live with another person in a very special and intimate way. Colossians chapter 3, starting in verse 12, actually provides the attitude or the perspective of those who are married to each other. Actually, he's not even talking about married couples here. He's talking about Christians. But think about this in light of two people who are married to each other. He says, so as those who have been chosen of God, holy and beloved, put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience, bearing with one another, and forgiving each other. Whoever has a complaint against anyone, just as the Lord forgave you, so also should you. Beyond all these things, put on love, which is the perfect bond of unity. Let the peace of Christ rule in your hearts, and be thankful. I mean, think about these things in application to a marriage. Shouldn't married people be this way toward each other? We're talking about Christians, ideally, of course, right? But shouldn't two Christians have this attitude toward each other? Of course, this applies to Christians, but it also applies to a husband and wife who are married in God's sight, in the Lord, that is. So that defines the attitude or disposition of a Christian husband and wife. Matthew 19, verse 6 there, Jesus says, "What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate." And by the way, that doesn't apply just to marriage. That applies to whatever God has brought together. We have no right to separate that, which means you're making a lifelong commitment, not a conditional commitment like I'll marry her so long as, or, you know, only until, or anything else. If you get married, then you get married for life. I realize divorces happen, and we're not sanctioning that, but at the same time, we're looking at the plan, what the plan is all about. What the plan is that God sanctions marriage, and God hates divorce, okay? We understand that. So what does the plan say, and what do we do to follow that, okay? So we don't want to just be against divorce. We also want to be against what God says about divorce, and that is anything that leads up to it, even if divorce never actually happens. The treachery is bad enough that can lead to that, or can inspire that, if you will. Husbands, love your wives. Act in their best interest to as a sacrifice to yourself. Treat them as your soulmate. And Paul says in Ephesians 5, as your own body. Love your wife in a consistent manner with how Christ loves the church. And again, that sounds easy. The instruction is simple and general, if you will, and straightforward. But the implications are very profound. If you husbands love your wives as I love my wife in a manner that is unconditional and Christ-like, well, then we're going to be acting in their best interests and taking care of them in a way that we couldn't otherwise. And then wives also are to be subject to and respectful of their husbands, voluntarily putting themselves under his leadership, because that's what subjection means here, a voluntary decision, and to respect his God-given position and responsibility in the home. She doesn't undermine his leadership or authority by insisting that her will be done instead of Christ. So we have, ideally, again, we are speaking ideally, we have a husband who is trying hard to head the household, head his marriage, if you will, and the wife is there as his greatest supporter, as his ardent supporter, okay, always standing there supporting him and providing for him and giving him whatever he needs in order to carry out his role. He reciprocates, of course, by providing the leadership and the guidance and the security that she longs for and desperately needs. It's a mutually beneficial relationship. It's a win-win situation when it is handled in the right way. Fathers, bring up your children in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Some other versions say in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Teach them who the Lord is, and teach them how to live in fellowship with him, and teach them how to serve him, and by all means, lead by example. Don't just teach your children one thing and then live another. That is how you exasperate children. Okay, so there's something here that is for fathers as well. We can't teach poor leadership or hypocrisy or put stumbling blocks, but rather we need to teach the right way and then live that way ourselves. Okay, it's so important to do that. There are so many children out there in the world or even in so-called church families, okay, that really have no idea what it means to live right with the Lord. They got the church going thing down. You know, they got the vacation Bible school thing down. They've got the, you know, we stand when we're supposed to. We sit down when we're supposed to. We sing when we're supposed to. We pray when we're supposed to. But they don't necessarily know anything about what it means to walk in the light and walk in fellowship with God. That's where the parents need to pull them aside, not just once, not just twice, but all the time, as much as is needed and whenever it is needed, and teach them how to live right with God. And of course, you cannot do that successfully without doing that yourself. Even the children have some responsibility here. They are to obey their parents in the Lord. Why? For this is right. Whenever Paul says this is right, he means that this is right with God. This is how God would want you to do that. Honor your father and mother. Ephesians 6:1. These are not mere suggestions, but this is a God-given prescription for proper respect and compliance with dad's leadership of the family. God has great favor for those children who do so. Obviously, in that scenario, he's talking about children who are under their father's household or in their father's household, under his roof, under his leadership there. Once you get out on your own, well, then you're not obedient to your father because you create your own household, and now you have your own leadership. If you're a man or if you get married, then well, you're supporting that leadership. But the honoring part, that is lifelong. Mark chapter 7, verse 9 through 13, Jesus chastises the Jews who say, well, we've given our contribution to God, but at the expense of our parents. And Jesus says, well, that's not what the law teaches. The law says you are honor your parents. Take care of your parents, basically, is what he's saying, when they get older and less capable of taking care of themselves. Obviously, contribution to the Lord is noble. There's no question. A contribution to the Lord at the expense of your parents' welfare, well, that violates the command. However you see that, however you implement this, it comes up the same thing, okay? You're not to dishonor your parents in order to claim to honor God. You honor your parents. That doesn't mean you have to like what they're doing. It doesn't mean you have to agree with everything they do. And it doesn't mean they're all necessarily even going to be Christians. It means you honor their position in your life as your parents. This is not a comprehensive plan, but it is essential, and it does steer us in the right direction. And if everyone in the family does this, fulfills their individual responsibilities to God, then that family most certainly will be functional and not dysfunctional. Well, we've been talking about men and addressing men and their roles and their responsibilities, so I want to consider some of his roles more directly now, and we'll spend the rest of the lesson doing that here. So the husband, the father, is the head of the family. He's not just a figurehead where everyone pretends he's the head. Yeah, dad's the head, but we all know mom really is, you know, like I described earlier. But he properly serves in this capacity. He takes God's charge to him very seriously. He treats that stewardship entrusted to him, in other words, his marriage and his family, he treats that with respect and with dignity. We're told in 1 Timothy 3, and obviously that section is talking about candidates for elders, but it also applies to a mature, ideal perspective of Christian men and their households. And one of the things it says there is that a man is to manage his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. Well, if a man won't do that, or if he refuses to learn how to do that, then what is he doing? Well, he's choosing a dysfunctional course of action. He's choosing to have a dysfunctional family. Not only that, but he is rejecting inspired instruction. In another place, 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 8, Paul says, he who rejects this instruction that he's giving there is not rejecting man, but the God who gives his Holy Spirit to you. I want you to take it that seriously. And when God gives you some plan here to follow and says, do this or do this way, and you say, I don't want to do that way, understand that you are rejecting God, you're rejecting his Spirit, and therefore you're rejecting, in essence, your own salvation. You can't have it both ways. God tells you what the plan is, and you follow that. God tells me what his plan is, and I follow that. If I don't, well, then I suffer the consequences of that. But I can't sit there and say, God, I don't want to follow your plan, but I really want your salvation. Well, you can't have that both ways. Management is really what we're talking about here. Management of people is a key ingredient to leadership. If you refuse to manage, then you cease to be a leader. Once again, I'm talking about not just families, I'm also talking about churches, okay? This applies to elders and any of the spiritual leaders of a congregation as much as it does to a domestic family, okay? If you're not managing people, well, then you're not leading because management is key to leadership. Management does not mean barking orders, threatening with intimidation, or blowing your stack when someone disobeys you. Management is having a Christ-like oversight of the entire family and the environment in which the family lives. That is good management. Having Christ-like oversight of the people and also the place in which they live. Not just the people, but also the place. Not just the place, but also the people. Okay? A lot of times you see in churches, it's very common. I think elders in every congregation struggle with this to some extent. You know, they focus on the environment more than they focus on the people. The environment being the church building. Church building issues come up and we immediately gravitate toward that. Elders do, or preachers do even sometimes. And yet the people kind of get pushed aside there. It's really management of the people and the environment, not building issues, but the environments, okay? So what's going on here? What is the tone of what we do here when we assemble? How is this functioning here? And what is being said and so on? Is it encouraging? Is it discouraging? And so on. That's part of the environment as well. That needs to be managed. Let all that you do be done in love. We talked about that in a recent lesson about men. Let all that you do, men, be done in love. So in our management of people and in our management of our people's environments, we are doing whatever we do in love for those people. Paul is clear. If a man will not manage his own household, he has no right to be in a leadership position in the congregation. Quite honestly, he has no right to be ahead of his family. We're not saying that we should revoke that from him, but we're just simply saying what God is saying. Okay? In the role of a husband, a man is to be the head of his wife, not ahead of someone else's wife, okay? Not ahead of all women, but the head of his wife. He is to be her leader, provider, protector, and I think most importantly, her intimate friend. He is to be faithful. That's what the really husband of one wife in 1 Timothy 3:2 says. Literally, that means a one-woman man. That's literally how the Greek is translated there. And that goes well beyond just sexual faithfulness. That also speaks of honesty, trustworthiness, dependency, authenticity, integrity, all of those things that we want from other people. This is where that man's faithfulness or trustworthiness is to be applied in his relationship with his wife. Obviously, we've talked about loving her, husbands loving your wives. This is, again, not a suggestion, but a command. And by the way, don't just love her when she cooperates or when she reciprocates or when she's on her best behavior. You, husbands, are to love her even when she is uncooperative. That doesn't mean support or enable her uncooperativeness, okay? Doesn't mean enable her irresponsibility. What it means, though, is that you love her, meaning you act in her best interest even when she is uncooperative or irresponsible. And how you would do that, of course, is to guide her back to that which is cooperative and responsible in whatever way is appropriate. If she is a Christian, well, then you need to treat her as 1 Peter 3:7 says, as a fellow heir. And there is an equality there, okay? I realize husbands have to have a leadership position there, and then the wives are to be submissive to that leadership position, supporting that and aiding that in whatever way they can. But in this particular perspective, as a fellow heir, here's where we're on an equal plane, okay? I'm not a better heir of God than my wife is. She is not a lesser heir of God than I am. We are fellow heirs. We're on the same plane. Don't you remember what Paul says in Galatians 3:28? You know, that in Christ there is neither male nor female, or husband or wife, by the way. There is neither master nor servant, nor Jew nor Gentile. We're all one. We're all level, if you will, in Christ. So we're talking about a spiritual perspective here, not a domestic one. We're not talking about what it's like in your day-to-day operations in your home, but we are talking about what it is like in one's relationship with Christ. I do say that some men treat other Christian women with more honor and respect than they do their own Christian wives. This is part of why I'm bringing this up, okay? And that ought not to be. You ought to treat your wife best of all. And he ought to be a representative of Christ in all that he does, not just at the church, not just when others are looking, but in all of his behavior, his conduct, and his thoughts. Husbands, if some of you are saying, I haven't done all of that, I haven't either. I'm just admitting to you that I have failed to live up to this ideal myself. But it doesn't mean that the ideal is not worth striving after. And it doesn't mean that the ideal has any less importance or any less effect, positive effect on us. Okay, it means that it is an ideal and we should strive to live toward that. In the role of a father, a man is to be the ultimate authority figure over his children, especially, of course, when they're younger. And in a real sense, he is the closest role to God that they will see. He is really the first image of God that they see. Imagine if that gets spoiled, and then the children get all bitter and soured on God because of an ungodly or unchristian-like father. He is one who should manage and provide for those children's well-being, not just food and clothes and so on, but spiritual nurturing, moral education, value-oriented teaching skills. Anyone can throw food and clothes at a kid. Anyone can do that. But it takes a Christ-like father to lead his children to God. I'm not saying they will accept God or will accept that responsibility. My job as a parent was not to force my children to be baptized into Christ. My job as a parent was to teach them how to come to Christ, why to be baptized, and what all that means, and most importantly, lead by example. Whether they did it or not, that was up to them. But it was my job to lead them to that. And a father ought to be preparing his children to enter into the adult world with a Christ-like attitude and a big picture perspective. One thing I taught my kids from a very young age, and I continue to teach them, my job as a parent is to teach you how to be a good citizen and a faithful Christian. And I would counsel you, fathers, to do the same thing because it is very good advice. Teach your children or grandchildren, if you have those instead, okay, in your sphere of influence there. Teach your children how to be good citizens, what that means. And by the way, lead by example. And faithful Christians, what that means. And yes, lead by example. You'll go far if you do that. And they will be blessed by that instruction. So this all takes time to do this, to listen and communicate with the family. This is an important skill of leadership, is listening and communicating. And someone's going to come back and say, well, I'm not very good at listening or communicating. And my advice to you was, then learn how to get better. Instead of giving you some crutch and say, yeah, okay, this doesn't apply to you then. No, actually, you need to learn how to do better at listening and then at communicating. And there's plenty of books out there. There's plenty of astute Christian men out there that can teach you how to do both of those, and very well. And it's your responsibility to learn that. Your wife and your children need to know what God and you want of them. Now, I'll say this, too, because this is the other thing that comes at me sometimes when I say things like this. Men come back and say, well, you don't understand because I came from a broken, dysfunctional family. How can I learn how to lead a functional family if I came from a dysfunctional one? Well, guess what? I'm the product of a dysfunctional family, okay? And what I had to do was learn my lessons that I learned from that dysfunctional situation and then read God's word and learn how to be a functional father in a functional family instead. My parents were divorced when I was 5 years old, single mom, four kids, you know, fatherless family for all my childhood. I mean, you throw on your sob story. I've got one too, okay? And my whole point here is that that happened. There's nothing you can do about that. You can't go back and fix that. Sad as it is, that is what it is. And now it's time to move forward and to break that cycle. Remember, the cycle gets perpetuated until someone says, enough of that. And you might be that person. Really, you should be that person. It says, enough of that. I'm not going to repeat what was given to me. It has been my resolve, and honey's as well, not to repeat what we grew up with, but rather to learn from that and to use that as a teaching tool. Even those who claim to grow up in the church, so to speak, as we talked about this morning, we don't always see much better situations there. We see a lot of the same problems in church families that we do in secular families. Why is that? Well, it's not a problem with the Bible. It's not a problem with the instruction. It's a problem with fathers and mothers and families simply not paying attention to the pattern, not listening to the master plan, and departing from that and becoming dysfunctional in the process. The point is, you can learn this. In fact, it needs to be learned. It can be done. And it needs to be done. And you, men, are the ones to do that. God has entrusted you, men, with the lives of very precious people, your wife and your children. And he's provided you with the tools and the resources to equip you to carry out that charge. It is up to you to take the initiative and to start it on its path to a objective end. As we said, groups of people need to be organized and governed. Men are entrusted with that responsibility first and foremost. If a man will not do that, well, then that creates a dysfunctional situation. And that forces a wife and children into roles that they are not expected to fulfill. Or it allows them to define and create their own roles, which, again, they're not supposed to do, as opposed to the God-given pattern. So when men fail to be the leaders and organizers of their own home, what happens is there creates a vacuum, and the children and the wife has to rush in and fill that vacuum, usually inappropriately, because, first of all, they're not trained to do it that way, and secondly, they're not supposed to do that. And so we see that ends up in a dysfunctional pattern there. On the other hand, men who lead well, take their stewardship to heart, end up with usually strong, healthy, Christ-centered families, which is exactly what every family wants, but also every congregation longs for and needs. We cannot be a congregation of dysfunctional families. We need strong families. We need strong leadership in the families in order for the congregation itself to be strong and functional. Just as dysfunctional families may be perpetuated for generations to come, so can functional families. If you lay the seeds of what a good family is and what it looks like and have led by example, then those children, when they grow up, guess what they're going to do more than likely? They're going to recreate that scenario in their families, and you will have perpetuated your efforts there into another generation. So men, ask yourself, what kind of family do I have and how much godly leadership am I providing? The purpose of this series is not to belittle you, not to berate you, not to magnify your mistakes, but rather to encourage each of us from this point forward to commit to doing far better than whatever we did in the past. That is my encouragement to you. I can't fix what you did wrong. You can't fix what I did wrong. But I know this. We can start new. We can start fresh today and say, this is what I will do. Not, hey, I'm open to that, or I'm willing to accept. You know, forget about that language. Remember, we talked about that. We got that out of the way. Now it's time to commit and say, I will, and then start doing something to fulfill that commitment. Remember God's promise. He says, I will never leave you or desert you. Remember also our expected response to that promise. Follow his word without deviation and have faith and courage to do what is right. Remember what he told Joshua that we talked about last week. Be strong and courageous. But he also said, but don't depart from what I taught you. Here's the plan. Now it's our part to put the plan into action. That's my lesson for this morning. I hope that it has found fertile hearts and it was received in the spirit in which it was intended. If there's anyone here that is ready to become a Christian, ready to recommit to God, you want to make that public, this would be your time to come forward as we stand and sing the song Richard has selected.